Why? I asked.
Because I need to put this right.
Everybody makes mistakes.
We sent an agent after Beck, undercover, a woman. She disappeared.
Silence. When? I asked.
7 weeks ago.
You looked for her?
We don't know where to look. We don't know where Beck goes. We don't even know where he lives. He has no registered property. His house must be owned by some phantom corporation. It's a needle in a haystack.
Haven't you tailed him?
We've tried. He has bodyguards and drivers. They're too good.
For the DEA?
For us. We're on our own. The Justice Department disowned the operation when I screwed up.
Even though there's an agent missing?
They don't know there's an agent missing. We put her in after they closed us down. She's off the books.
I stared at her.
This whole thing is off the books.
So how are you working it?
I'm a team leader. Nobody's looking over my shoulder day to day. I'm pretending I'm working on something else. But I'm not. I'm working on this.
So nobody knows this woman is missing?
Just my team. 7 of us. And now you.
I said nothing.
We came straight here. We need a break. Why else would we fly up here on a Sunday?
The room went quiet. I looked from her to Elliot and back to her. They needed me. I needed them. And I liked them. I liked them a lot. They were honest, likable people. They were like the best of the people I used to work with. I'll trade, I said. Information for information. We'll see how we get along, and then we'll take it from there.
What do you need?
I told her I needed 10-year-old hospital records from a place called Eureka in California. I told her what kind of a thing to look for. I told her I would stay in Boston until she got back to me. I told her not to put anything on paper. Then they left, and that was it for day 2. Nothing happened on day 3 or day 4. I hung around. I find Boston acceptable for a couple of days. It's what I call a 48 town. Anything more than 48 hours and it starts to get tiresome. Of course, most places are like that for me. I'm a restless person. So by the start of day 5, I was going crazy. I was ready to assume they had forgotten all about me. I was ready to call it quits and get back on the road. I was thinking about Miami. It would be a lot warmer down there. But late in the morning, the phone rang. It was her voice. It was nice to hear.
We're on our way up. Meet you by that big statue of whoever it is on a horse, halfway around the Freedom Trail, 3 o'clock.
It wasn't a very precise rendezvous, but I knew what she meant. It was a place in the North End, near a church. It was springtime, and too cold to want to go there without a purpose, but I got there early anyway. I sat on a bench next to an old woman feeding house sparrows and rock doves with torn-up crusts of bread. She looked at me and moved to another bench. The birds swarmed around her feet, pecking at the grit. A watery sun was fighting rain clouds in the sky. It was Paul Revere on the horse. Duffy and Elliot showed up right on time. They were wearing black raincoats all covered in little loops and buckles and belts. They might as well have worn signs around their necks saying, Federal Agents from Washington, D.C. They sat down, Duffy on my left and Elliot on my right. I leaned back, and they leaned forward with their elbows on their knees.
Paramedics fished a guy out of the Pacific surf, Duffy said. 10 years ago, just south of Eureka, California. White male, about 40. He had been shot twice in the head and once in the chest. Small caliber, probably .22s. Then they figure he was thrown off a cliff into the ocean.
He was alive when they fished him out? I asked, although I already knew the answer.
Barely. He had a bullet lodged near his heart and his skull was broken, plus one arm and both legs and his pelvis from the fall, and he was half drowned. They operated on him for 15 straight hours. He was in intensive care for a month and in the hospital recuperating for another 6.
ID?
Nothing on him. He He's in the records as a John Doe.
Did they try to ID him?
No fingerprint match. Nothing on any missing persons lists. Nobody came to claim him.
I nodded, thinking, fingerprint computers tell you what they're told to tell you. What then?
He recovered. 6 months had passed. They were trying to work out what to do with him when he suddenly discharged himself. They never saw him again.
Did he tell them anything about who he was?
They diagnosed amnesia, certainly about the trauma, because that's almost inevitable. They figured he might be genuinely blank about the incident and the previous day or two, but they figured he must be able to remember things from before that, and they got the strong impression he was pretending not to. There's a fairly extensive case file. Psychiatrists, everything. They interviewed him regularly. He was extremely resolute. Never said a word about himself.
What was his physical condition when he left?
Pretty fair. He had visible scars from the GSWs, that's about all.
Okay. I leaned my head back and looked up at the sky.
Who was he?
Your guess, I said.
22s to the head and chest, Elliot said. Dumped in the ocean? Yeah, it's organized crime. An assassination. Some kind of hitman got to him.
I said nothing, looked up at the sky.
Who was he?
Duffy said again. I kept on looking up at the sky and dragged myself 10 years backward through time to a whole different world. You know anything about tanks? I asked.
Military tanks? Tracks and guns? Not really.
There's nothing to them. I mean, you like them to be able to move fast. You want some reliability. You don't object to some fuel economy. But if I've got a tank, and you've got a tank, what's the only thing I really want to know?
What?
Can I shoot you before you can shoot me? That's what I want to know. If we're a mile apart, can my gun reach you, or can your gun reach me?
So?
Of course, physics being physics, the likely answer is if I can hit you at a mile, then you can hit me at a mile. So it comes down to ammunition. If I stand off another 200 yards so your shell bounces off me without hurting me, can I develop a shell that doesn't bounce off you? That's what tanks are all about. The guy in the ocean was an Army intelligence officer who had been blackmailing an Army weapons specialist.
Why was he in the ocean?
Did you watch the Gulf War on TV? I asked.
I did, Elliot said.
Forget about the smart bombs. The real star of the show was the M1A1 Abrams main battle tank. It scored about 400 to zip against the Iraqis, who were using the best anybody ever had to give them. But having the war on TV meant that we'd shown our hand to the whole world, so we better get on with dreaming up some new stuff for the next time around. So we got on with it.
And?
Duffy asked. If you want a shell to fly farther and hit harder, you can stuff more propellant into it, or make it lighter, or both. Of course, if you're stuffing more propellant into it, you've got to do something pretty radical elsewhere to make it lighter, which is what they did. They took the explosive charge out of it. Which sounds weird, right? Like, what's it going to do? Go clang and bounce off? But they changed the shape. They dreamed up this thing that looks like a giant lawn dart, built-in fins and all. It's cast from tungsten and depleted uranium, the densest metals you can find. It goes real fast and real far. They called it the Long Rod Penetrator. Duffy glanced at me with her eyelids low and smiled and blushed all at the same time. I smiled back. They changed the name, I said. Now it's called the APFSDS. I told you they like initials. Armor-piercing, fin-stabilizing, discarding sabo. It's powered by its own little rocket motor, basically. It hits the enemy tank with tremendous kinetic energy. The kinetic energy changes to heat energy, just like they teach you in high school physics. It melts its way through in a split second, and sprays the inside of the enemy tank with a jet of molten metal, which kills the tankers and blows up anything explosive or flammable. It's a very neat trick. And either way, you shoot, you score, Because if the enemy armor is too thick, or you've fired from too far away, the thing just sticks partway in like a dart and spalls, which means it fragments the inner layer of the armor and throws scabs of scalding metal around inside like a hand grenade. The enemy crew come apart like frogs in a blender. It was a brilliant new weapon.
What about the guy in the ocean?
He got the blueprints from the guy he was blackmailing, piece by piece, over a long period of time. We were watching him. We knew exactly what he was doing. He was aiming to sell them to Iraqi intelligence. The Iraqis wanted to level the playing field for the next time around. The U.S. Army didn't want that to happen. Elliot stared at me.
So they had the guy killed?
I shook my head. We sent a couple of MPs down to arrest him. Standard operating procedure, all legal and above board, believe me. But it went wrong. He got away. He was going to disappear. The U.S. Army really didn't want that to happen.
So then they had him killed?
I looked up at the sky again, didn't answer.
That wasn't standard procedure, Elliot said, was it?
I said nothing.
It was off the books, wasn't it?
I didn't answer.
But he didn't die. What was his name?
Duffy said. Quinn. Turned out to be the single worst guy I ever met.
And you saw him in Beck's car on Saturday?
I nodded. He was being chauffeured away from Symphony Hall. I gave them all the details I had. But as I talked, we all knew the information was useless. It was inconceivable that Quinn would be using his previous identity. So all I had to offer was a physical description of a plain-looking white man, about 50 years old, with two 22 GSW scars on his forehead. Better than nothing, but it didn't really get them anywhere.
Why didn't his prints match?
Elliot asked. He was erased, like he never existed.
Why didn't he die?
Silenced 22, our standard-issue weapon for covert close work, but not a very powerful weapon.
Is he still dangerous?
Not to the Army. He's ancient history. This all was 10 years ago. The APF SDS will be in the museum soon. So will the Abrams tank.
So why try to trace him?
Because depending on exactly what he remembers, he could be dangerous to the guy who went to take him out. Elliot nodded, said nothing.
Did he look important?
Duffy asked.
On Saturday? In Beck's car?
He looked wealthy. Expensive cashmere overcoat, leather gloves, silk scarf. He looked like a guy who was accustomed to being chauffeured around. He just jumped right in, like he did it all the time.
Did he greet the driver?
I don't know.
We need to place him. We need context. How did he act? He was using Beck's car, but did he look entitled or like somebody was doing him a favor?
He looked entitled, like he uses it every day of the week.
So is he Beck's equal?
I shrugged. He could be Beck's boss.
Partner at best, Elliot said. RLA guy wouldn't travel to meet with an underling.
I don't see Quinn as somebody's partner.
What was he like?
Normal, for an intelligence officer, in most ways.
Except for the espionage.
Yes, except for that.
And whatever got him killed, off the books.
That too. Duffy had gone quiet. She was thinking hard. I was pretty sure she was thinking of ways she could use me. And I didn't mind at all.
Will you stay in Boston? She asked. Where we can find you?
I said I would, and they left, and that was the end of day 5. I found a scalper in a sports bar and spent most of days 6 and 7 at Fenway Park watching the Red Sox struggling through an early season homestand. The Friday game went 17 innings and ended very late, so I slept most of day 8 and then went back to Symphony Hall at night to watch the crowd. Maybe Quinn had season tickets to a concert series. But he didn't show. I replayed in my mind the way he had glanced at me. It might have been just that rueful, crowded sidewalk thing, but it might have been more. Susan Duffy called me again on the morning of day 9, Sunday. She sounded different. She sounded like a person who had done a lot more thinking. She sounded like a person with a plan.
Hotel lobby at noon.
She showed up in a car, alone. The car was a Taurus, built down to a very plain specification. It was grimy inside. A government vehicle. She was wearing faded denim jeans with good shoes and a battered leather jacket. Her hair was newly washed and combed back from her forehead. I got in on the passenger side, and she crossed 6 lanes of traffic and drove straight into the mouth of a tunnel that led to the Mass Pike.
"Zachary Beck has a son," she said.
She took an underground curve, fast, and the tunnel ended, and we came out into the weak midday April light right behind Fenway.
"He's a college junior. Some small, no-account liberal arts place, not too far from here, as it happens. We talked to a classmate in exchange for burying a cannabis problem. The son is called Richard Beck. Not a popular person. A little strange. Seems very traumatized by something that happened about 5 years ago."
"What kind of something?"
"He was kidnapped."
I said nothing.
"You see," Duffy said, "you know how often regular people get kidnapped these days?"
"No."
"Doesn't happen. It's an extinct crime. So it must have been a turf war thing. It's practically proof his dad's a racketeer."
"Well, that's a stretch."
"Okay, but it's very persuasive. And it was never reported. FBI has no record of it. Whatever happened was handled privately, and not very well. The classmate says Richard Beck is missing an ear."
"So?" She didn't answer. She just drove west. I stretched out on the passenger seat and watched her out of the corner of my eye. She looked good. She was long and lean and pretty, and she had life in her eyes. She was wearing no makeup. She was one of those women who absolutely didn't need to. I was very happy to let her drive me around. But she wasn't just driving me around. She was taking me somewhere, that was clear. She had come with a plan.
"I studied your whole service record, in great detail. You're an impressive guy."
"Not really."
"And you've, got big feet." "That's good, too."
"Why?"
"You'll see."
"Tell me."
"We're very alike, you and me. We have something in common. I want to get close to Zachary Beck to get my agent back. You want to get close to him to find Quinn."
"Your agent is dead. 8 weeks now? It would be a miracle. You should face it." She said nothing. "And I don't care about Quinn." She glanced right and shook her head.
"Oh, you do. You really do. I can see that from here. It's eating you up. He's unfinished business. And my guess is you're the sort of guy who hates unfinished business."
She paused for a second.
"And I'm proceeding on the assumption that my agent is still alive, unless and until you supply definitive proof to the contrary."
"Me?"
"I can't use one of my people. You understand that, right? This whole thing is illegal as far as the Justice Department is concerned, so whatever I do next has to stay off the books. And my guess is you're the sort of guy who understands off-the-books operations and is comfortable with them. Even prefers them, maybe."
"So?"
"I need to get somebody inside Beck's place, and I've decided it's going to be you. You're going to be my very own long-rod penetrator."
"How?"
"Richard Beck is going to take you there."
She came off the pike about 40 miles west of Boston and turned north into the Massachusetts countryside. We passed through picture-perfect New England villages. Fire departments were out on the curbs polishing their trucks. Birds were singing. People were putting stuff on their lawns and pruning their bushes. There was the smell of wood smoke in the air. We stopped at a motel in the middle of nowhere. It was an immaculate place with quiet brick facings and blinding white trim. There were 5 cars in the lot. They were blocking access to the 5 end rooms. They were all government vehicles. Stephen Elliott was waiting in the middle room with five men. They had hauled their desk chairs in from their own rooms. They were sitting in a neat semicircle. Duffy led me inside and nodded to Elliott. I figured it was a nod that meant, I told him, and he hasn't said no. Yet. She moved to the window and turned so that she faced the room. The daylight was bright behind her. It made her hard to see. She cleared her throat. The room went quiet.
Okay, listen up, people. One more time. This is off the books. This is not officially sanctioned, and this will be done on our own time and at our own risk. Anybody wants out, just leave now.
Nobody moved. Nobody left. It was a smart tactic. It showed me she and Elliot had at least five guys who would follow them to hell and back.
We have less than 48 hours. Day after tomorrow, Richard Beck heads home for his mother's birthday. Our source says he does it every year. Cuts classes and all. His father sends a car with two pro bodyguards because the kid is terrified of a repeat abduction. We're going to exploit that fear. We're going to take down the bodyguards and kidnap him.
She paused. Nobody spoke.
Our aim is to get into Zachary Beck's house. We can assume the supposed kidnappers themselves wouldn't exactly be welcome there. So what will happen is that Reacher will immediately rescue the kid from the supposed kidnappers. It'll be a tight sequence, kidnap, rescue, like that. The kid comes over all grateful, and Reacher is greeted like a hero around the family hearth.
People sat quiet at first. Then they stirred. The plan was so full of holes it made a Swiss cheese look solid. I stared straight at Duffy. Then I found myself staring out the window. There were ways of plugging the holes, I thought. I felt my brain start to move. I wondered how many of the holes Duffy had already spotted. I wondered how many of the answers she had already gotten. I wondered how she knew I loved stuff like this.
We have an audience of one. All that matters is what Richard Beck thinks. The whole thing will be phony from beginning to end, but he's got to be absolutely convinced it's real.
Elliot looked at me.
Weaknesses?
Two, I said. First, how do you take the bodyguards down without really hurting them? I assume you're not that far off the books.
Speed, shock, surprise, he said. The kidnap team will have machine pistols with plenty of blank ammunition, plus a stun grenade. Soon as the kid is out of the car, we toss a flashbang in. Lots of sound and fury. There'll be days, nothing more. But the kid will assume they're hamburger meat.
Okay. But second, this whole thing is like method acting, right? I'm some kind of a passerby, and coincidentally, I'm the type of guy who can rescue him, which makes me smart and capable. So why wouldn't I just haul his ass around to the nearest cops? Or wait for the cops to come to us? Why wouldn't I stick around and give evidence and make all kinds of witness statements? Why would I want to immediately drive him all the way home? Elliot turned to Duffy.
He'll be terrified. He'll want you to.
But why would I agree? It doesn't matter what he wants. What matters is what is logical for me to do. Because we don't have an audience of one. We have an audience of two. Richard Beck and Zachary Beck. Richard Beck there and then, and Zachary Beck later. He'll be looking at it in retrospect. We've got to convince him just as much.
The kid might ask you not to go to the cops. Like last time.
But why would I listen to him? If I was Mr. Normal, the cops would be the first thing on my mind. I'd want to do everything strictly by the book.
He would argue with you.
And I would ignore him. Why would a smart and capable adult listen to a crazy kid? Now, it's a whole. It's too cooperative, too purposeful, too phony, too direct. Zachary Beck would rumble it in a minute.
Maybe you get him in a car and you're being chased.
I'd drive straight to a police station.
Shit,
Duffy said. It's a plan, but we need to get real. I looked out the window again. It was bright out there. I saw a lot of green stuff. Trees, bushes, distant wooded hillsides dusted with new leaves. In the corner of my eye, I saw Elliot and Duffy looking down at the floor of the room. Saw the five guys sitting still. They looked like a capable bunch. Two of them were a little younger than me, tall and fair. Two were about my age, plain and ordinary. One was a lot older, stooped and gray. I thought long and hard. Kidnap, rescue, Beck's house. I need to be in Beck's house. I really do, because I need to find Quinn. Think about the long game. I looked at the whole thing from the kid's point of view, then I looked at it again from his father's point of view. It's a plan, I said again, but it needs perfecting. So I need to be the sort of person who wouldn't go to the cops. No. No, better still, right in front of Richard Beck's eyes, I need to become the sort of person who can't go to the cops. How? Duffy asked. I looked straight at her. I'll have to hurt somebody. By accident, in the confusion. Another passerby, some innocent party, some kind of ambiguous circumstance. Maybe I run somebody over, some old lady walking her dog. Maybe even I kill her. I panic and I run.
Too difficult to stage. And not really enough to make you run anyway. I mean, accidents happen in circumstances like these.
I nodded. The room stayed quiet. I closed my eyes and thought some more, and saw the beginnings of a sketchy scene take shape right there in my mind. Okay. How about this? I'll kill a cop. By accident. Nobody spoke. I opened my eyes. It's a grand slam. You see that? It's totally perfect. It puts Zachary Beck's mind at rest about why I didn't act normally and go to the cops. You don't go to the cops if you've just killed one of their own, even if it's an accident. He'll understand that. And it'll give me a reason to stay on at his house afterward, which I'll need to do. He'll think I'm in hiding. He'll be grateful about the rescue, and he's a criminal anyway, so his conscience won't get in his way. There were no objections, just silence, and then a slow, indefinable murmur of assessment, agreement, consent. I scoped it out, beginning to end. Think about the long game. I smiled. And it gets better, I said. He might even hire me. In fact, I think he'll be very tempted to hire me, because we're creating the illusion that his family's suddenly under attack, and he'll be down by two bodyguards, and he'll know I'm better than they were anyway because they lost and I didn't. And he'll be happy to hire me because as long as he thinks I'm a cop killer and he's sheltering me, he'll think he owns me. Duffy smiled, too.
So let's go to work. We've got less than 48 hours.
The two younger guys were tagged as the kidnap team. We decided they would be driving a Toyota pickup from the DEA's stock of impounded vehicles. They would be using confiscated Uzis filled with 9mm blanks. They would have a stun grenade filched from the DEA SWAT stores. Then we started to rehearse my role as the rescuer. Like all good scam artists, we decided I should stick as close to the truth as possible. So I would be an ex-military drifter in the right place at the right time. I would be armed, which in the circumstances would be technically illegal in Massachusetts, but which would be in character and plausible. I need a big old-fashioned revolver, I said. I have to be carrying something appropriate for a citizen, and the whole thing has to be a big drama, beginning to end. The Toyota comes at me, I need to disable it. I need to shoot it up. So I need three real bullets and three blanks, in strict sequence. The three real bullets for the truck, the three blanks for the people.
We could load any gun like that, Elliot said.
But I'll need to see the chambers, right before I fire. I won't fire a mixed load without a visual check. I need to know I'm starting in the right place, so I need a revolver. A big one, not some small thing, so I can see clearly. He saw my point, made a note. Then we nominated the old guy as the local cop. Duffy proposed he should just blunder into my field of fire. Nah, I said. It has to be the right kind of mistake, not just a careless shot. Beck Sr. needs to be impressed with me in the right kind of way. I need to do it deliberately, but recklessly. Like I'm a madman, but a madman who can shoot. Duffy agreed, and Elliot thought through a mental list of available vehicles and offered me an old panel van. Said I could be a delivery guy. said it would give me a legitimate reason to be hanging out on the street. We made lists, on paper and in our heads. The two guys my age were sitting there without an assigned task, and they were unhappy about it. "You're backup cops," I said. "Suppose the kid doesn't even see me shoot the first one. He might have fainted or something. You need to chase us in a car, and I'll take you out when I'm certain he's watching."
"Can't have backup cops," the old guy said. "I mean, what's going on here? Suddenly the whole place is swarming with cops for no good reason?"
"College cops," Duffy said. "You know, those rent-a-cop guys colleges have? They just happen to be there. I mean, where else would you find them?"
"Excellent," I said. "They can start from right inside the campus. They can control the whole thing by radio from the rear."
"How will you take them out?"
Elliot asked me, like it was an issue. I nodded. I saw the problem. I would have fired 6 shots by then. "I can't reload, not while I'm driving. Not with blanks. The kid might notice."
"Can you ram them? Force them off the road?"
"Not in a crummy old van." "Now, I'll have to have a second revolver, preloaded, waiting inside the van. In the glove compartment, maybe."
"You're running around with 2 6-shooters?" the old guy said. "That's a little odd in Massachusetts."
I nodded. "It's a weak point. We're going to have to risk a few."
"So I should be in plain clothes, like a detective. Shooting at a uniformed cop is beyond reckless. That would be a weak point, too."
"Okay. Agreed. Excellent. You're a detective, and you pull out your badge, and I think it's a gun. That happens.
But how do we die? We just clutch our stomachs and fall over like an old Wild West show?"
"Yeah, that's not convincing," Elliot said. "This whole thing has got to look exactly right, for Richard Beck's sake." "We need Hollywood stuff," Duffy said. "Kevlar vests and condoms filled with fake blood that explode off of a radio signal."
"Can we get it?" I asked.
"From New York or Boston, maybe."
"We're tight for time."
"Tell me about it."
That was the end of day 9. Duffy wanted me to move into the motel and offered to have somebody drive me back to my Boston hotel for my luggage. I told her I didn't have any luggage, and she looked at me sideways but didn't say anything. I took a room next to the old guy. Somebody drove out and got pizza. Everybody was running around and making phone calls. They left me alone. I lay on my bed and thought the whole thing through again, beginning to end, from my point of view. I made a list in my head of all the things we hadn't considered. It was a long list. But there was one item bothering me above all. Not exactly on the list, kind of parallel to it. I got off my bed and went to find Duffy. She was out in the lot, hurrying back to her room from her car. "Zachary Beck isn't the story here," I told her. "He can't be. If Quinn's involved, then Quinn's the boss. He wouldn't play second fiddle. Unless Beck is a worse guy than Quinn, and I don't even want to think about that."
"Maybe Quinn changed," she said. "He was shot 2 in the head. Maybe that kind of rewired his brains, diminished him somehow."
I said nothing. She hurried away. I went back to my room. Day 10 started with the arrival of the vehicles. The old guy got a 7-year-old Chevy Caprice to act as his police unmarked. It was the one with the Corvette motor in it, from the final model year before General Motors stopped making them. It looked just right. The pickup was a big thing, painted faded red. It had a bull bar on the front. I saw the younger guys talking about how they would use it. My ride was a plain brown panel van. It was the most anonymous truck I had ever seen. It had no side windows and 2 small rear windows. I checked inside for a glove compartment. It had one.
"Okay?"
Elliot asked me. I slapped it side like van people do, and it boomed faintly in response. "Perfect. I want the revolvers to be big 44 magnums. I want 3 heavy, soft-nosed bullets and 9 blanks. Make the blanks as loud as you can get."
"Okay. Why soft-nose?"
"I'm worried about ricochets. I don't want to hurt anybody by accident. Soft-nosed slugs will deform and stick to what they hit. I'm going to fire 1 into the radiator and 2 at the tires. I want you to pump the tires way high, so they'll explode when I hit them. We got to make it spectacular." Elliot hurried away, and Duffy came up to me.
"You'll need these," she said.
She had a coat and a pair of gloves for me.
"You'll look more realistic if you're wearing them. It'll be cold, and the coat will hide the gun."
I took them from her and tried on the coat. It fit pretty well. She was clearly a good judge of sizes.
The psychology will be tricky. You're going to have to be flexible. The kid might be catatonic. You might need to coax some reaction out of him. But ideally, he'll be awake and talking. In which case, I think you need to show a little reluctance about getting yourself more and more involved. Ideally, you need to let him talk you into driving him all the way home. But at the same time, you need to be dominant. You need to keep events moving along so he doesn't have time to dwell on exactly what he's seeing.
Okay. In which case, I'm going to change my ammunition requisition. I'm going to make the second bullet in the second gun a real one. I'll tell him to get down on the floor, and then I'll blow out the window behind him. He'll think it was the college cops shooting at us. Then I'll tell him to get up again. It'll increase his sense of danger, and it'll get him used to doing what I tell him, and it'll make him a little happier to watch the college cops get it in the neck. Because I don't want him fighting me, trying to stop me. I might wreck the van and kill both of us.
In fact, you need to bond with him, she said. He needs to speak well of you later. Because I agree, getting hired on up there would hit the jackpot. It would give you access. So try to impress the kid, but keep it very subtle. You don't need him to like you. You just need to make him think you're a tough guy who knows what he's doing.
I went to find Elliot, and then the two guys playing the college cops came to find me. We arranged that they would fire blanks at me first, then I would fire one blank at them, then I would shoot out the van's rear window, and then I would fire another blank, and finally, I would fire my last three blanks in a spaced group. On the final shot, they would blow out their own windshield with a real bullet from one of their own guns, and then they would go sliding off the road like they had lost a tire or been hit.
Don't get confused about which load is which, one of them said.
Yeah, you either, I said back. We had more pizza for lunch, and then went out to cruise the target area. We parked a mile short and went over a couple of maps. Then we risked three separate passes in two cars right past the college gate. I would have preferred more time to study, but we were worried about being conspicuous. We drove back to the motel in silence and regrouped in Elliot's room.
Looks okay, I said. Which way will they turn?
Maine is north of here, Duffy said. We can assume he lives somewhere near Portland.
I nodded. But I think they'll go south. Look at the maps. You get to the highway faster that way. And standard security doctrine is to get on wide, busy roads as soon as possible.
It's a gamble.
They'll go south.
Anything else? Elliot asked.
I'd be nuts to stick with the van. Old man Beck will figure if I was doing this for real, I'd ditch it and steal a car.
Where?
Duffy asked. The map shows a mall next to the highway.
Okay, we'll stash one there.
Spare keys under the bumper? Elliot asked.
Duffy shook her head.
No, too phony. We need this whole thing to be absolutely convincing. He'll have to steal it for real.
I don't know how. I've never stolen a car. The room went quiet. All I know is what I learned in the Army. Military vehicles are never locked, and they don't have ignition keys. They start off a button.
Okay, Elliot said. No problem is insuperable. We'll leave it unlocked, but you'll act like it is locked. You'll pretend to jimmy the door. We'll leave a load of wire and a bunch of coat hangers nearby. Maybe you could ask the kid to find something for you, make him feel involved. It'll help the illusion. Then you screw around with it, and hey, the door pops open. We'll loosen the shroud on the steering column, and we'll strip the right wires and only the right wires. You find them and touch them together, and you're an instant bad guy. Brilliant,
Duffy said. Elliot smiled.
I do my best. Let's take a break, Duffy said. Start again after dinner.
The final pieces fell into place after dinner. Two of the guys got back with the last of the equipment. They had a matched pair of Colt Anacondas for me. They were big, brutal weapons. They looked expensive. I didn't ask where they got them from. They came with a box of real 44 Magnums and a box of 44 blanks. The blanks came from a hardware store. They were designed for a heavy-duty nail gun, the sort of thing that punches nails straight into concrete. I opened each Anaconda cylinder and scratched an X against one of the chambers with the tip of a nail scissor. A Colt revolver's cylinder steps around clockwise, which is different from a Smith & Wesson, which rotates counterclockwise. The X would represent the first chambers to be fired. I would line it up at the 10 o'clock position where I could see it, and it would step around and fall under the hammer with the first pull of the trigger. Duffy brought me a pair of shoes. They were my size. The right one had a cavity carved into the heel. She gave me a wireless email device that fit snugly into the space.
"That's why I'm glad you've got big feet," she said. "Made it easier to fit."
"Is it reliable?"
"It better be. It's a new government issue. All departments are doing their concealed communications with it now."
"Great," I said. "In my career, more foul-ups have been caused by faulty technology than any other single cause."
"It's the best we can do. They'd find anything else. They're bound to search you. And the theory is, if they're scanning for radio transmissions, all they'll hear is a brief burst of modem screech. They'll probably think it's static."
They had three blood effects from a New York theatrical costumier. They were big and bulky. Each was a foot-wide square of Kevlar that was to be taped to the victim's chest. They had rubber gore reservoirs and radio receivers and firing charges and batteries.
"Wear loose shirts, guys," Elliot said.
The radio triggers were separate buttons I would have to tape to my right forearm. They were wired to batteries I would have to carry in my inside pocket. The buttons were big enough to feel through my coat and my jacket and my shirt, and I figured I would look okay supporting the Colt's weight with my left hand. We rehearsed the sequence. First, the pickup driver. That button would be nearest my wrist. I would trigger it with my index finger. Second, the pickup passenger. That button would be in the middle. Middle finger. Third, the old guy playing the cop. That button would be nearest my elbow. Ring finger.
"You'll have to lose them afterward," Elliot said. "They'll search you for sure at Beck's house. You'll have to stop at a men's room or something and get rid of them."
We rehearsed endlessly in the motel lot. We laid out the road in miniature. By midnight, we were as solid as we were ever going to get. We figured we would need all of 8 seconds, beginning to end.
"You have the critical decision," Duffy said to me. "It's your call. If there's anything wrong when the Toyota is coming at you, anything at all, then you abort and you watch it go on by. We'll clean it up somehow. But you'll be firing 3 live rounds in a public place, and I don't want any stray pedestrians getting hit, or cyclists or joggers. You'll have less than a second to decide."
"Understood," I said, although I really didn't see any easy way of cleaning it up if it had already gotten that far. Then Elliot took a last couple of phone calls and confirmed they had a college security cruiser on loan and were putting a plausible old Nissan Maxima behind the mall's flagship department store. The Maxima had been impounded from a small-time marijuana grower in New York State. They still had tough drug laws down there. They were putting phony Massachusetts plates on it and filling it with the kind of junk a department store sales lady might be expected to haul around with her.
"Bed now," Duffy called. "Big day tomorrow."
That was the end of day 10. Duffy brought donuts and coffee to my room for breakfast on day 11.
Early. Her and me. Alone.
We went through the whole thing one last time. She showed me photographs of the agent she had inserted 59 days ago. She was a blonde 30-year-old who had gotten a clerk's job with Bizarre Bazaar using the name Teresa Daniel. Teresa Daniel was petite and looked resourceful. I looked hard at the pictures and memorized her features, but it was another woman's face I was seeing in my mind.
"I'm assuming she's still alive," Duffy said. "I have to."
I said nothing.
"Try hard to get hired. We checked your recent history the same way Beck might. You come out pretty vague. Plenty missing that would worry me, but I don't think it would worry him."
I gave the photographs back to her. "I'm a shoo-in," I said. "The illusion reinforces itself. He's left short-handed, and he's under attack all at the same time. But I'm not going to try too hard. In fact, I'm going to come across a little reluctant. I think anything else would seem phony."
"Okay. You've got 7 objectives, of which numbers 1, 2, and 3 are take a lot of care. We can assume these are extremely dangerous people."
I nodded. "We can do more than assume. If Quinn's involved, we can absolutely guarantee it."
"So act accordingly. Gloves off from the start."
"Yes," I said. I put my arm across my chest and started massaging my left shoulder with my right hand. Then I stopped myself. surprised. An army psychiatrist once told me that type of unconscious gesture represents feelings of vulnerability. It's defensive. It's about covering up and hiding. It's the first step toward curling yourself into a ball on the floor. Duffy must have read the same books, because she picked up on it and looked straight at me.
You're scared of Quinn, aren't you?
I'm not scared of anybody, but certainly I preferred it when he was dead.
We can cancel.
I shook my head. I'd like the chance to find him, believe me.
What went wrong with the arrest?
I shook my head again. I won't talk about that. She was quiet for a beat, but she didn't push it. Just looked away and paused and looked back and started up with the briefing again. Quiet voice. Efficient diction.
Objective number 4 is find my agent and bring her back to me.
I nodded.
5, bring me solid evidence I can use to nail Beck.
Okay. She paused again, just a beat.
6, find Quinn and do whatever you need to do with him. And then 7, get the hell out of there.
I nodded, said nothing.
We won't tail you. The kid might spot us. He'll be pretty paranoid by then. And we won't put a homing device on the Nissan because they'd probably find it later. You'll have to email us your location soon as you know it.
Okay.
Weaknesses? She asked.
I forced my mind away from Quinn. 3 weaknesses that I can see. 2 minor and 1 major. First minor one is that I'm going to blow the back window out of the van, but the kid will have about 10 minutes to realize the broken glass is in the wrong place and there isn't a corresponding hole in the windshield.
So don't do it.
I think I really need to. I think we need to keep the panic level high.
Okay. We'll put a bunch of boxes back there. You should have boxes anyway if you're a delivery man. They might obscure his view. If they don't, just hope he doesn't put 2 and 2 together inside 10 minutes.
I nodded. And 2nd, old man Beck is going to call the cops down here sometime, somehow. Maybe the newspapers, too. He's going to be looking for corroborating information.
We'll give the cops a script to follow, and they'll give the press something. They'll play ball for as long as they need to. What's the major weakness?
The bodyguards. How long can you hold them? You can't let them get near a phone or they'll call Beck, so you can't formally arrest them. You can't put them in the system. You'll have to hold them incommunicado, completely illegally. How long can you keep that going? She shrugged.
4 or 5 days, tops. We can't protect you any longer than that, so be real fast.
I plan to be. How long will the battery last on my email thing?
About 5 days. You'll be out by then. We can't give you a charger, it would be too suspicious. But you can use a cell phone charger, if you can find one.
Okay. She just looked at me. There was nothing more to say. Then she moved close and kissed me on the cheek. It was sudden. Her lips were soft. They left a dusting of donut sugar on my skin.
Good luck, she said. I don't think we've missed anything.
But we had missed a lot of things. They were glaring errors in our thinking, and they all came back to haunt me. Chapter 3. Duke the bodyguard came back to my room 5 minutes before 7 in the evening, which was way too early for dinner. I heard his footsteps outside and a quiet click as the lock turned. I was sitting on the bed. The email device was back in my shoe, and my shoe was back on my foot. "Get a nap, asshole?" he asked. "Why am I locked up?" I asked back. "Because you're a cop killer." I looked away. Maybe he had been a cop himself before he went private. Lots of ex-cops wind up in the security business as consultants or private eyes or bodyguards. Certainly he had some kind of an agenda, which could be a problem for me. But it meant he was buying Richard Beck's story without question, which was the upside. He looked at me for a second with nothing much in his face. Then he led me out of the room and down the 2 flights of stairs to the ground floor and through dark passageways toward the side of the house that faced north. I could smell salt air and damp carpet. There were rugs everywhere. Some places they were laid too deep on the floor. They glowed with muted colors. He stopped in front of a door and pushed it open and stepped back so I was channeled into a room. It was large and square and paneled with dark oak, rugs all over the floor. There were small windows in deep recesses, darkness and rock and gray ocean outside. There was an oak table. My two Colt Anacondas were lying on it, unloaded. Their cylinders were open. There was a man at the head of the table. He was sitting in an oak chair with arms and a tall back. He was the guy from Susan Duffy's surveillance photographs. In the flesh, he was mostly unremarkable. Not big, not small. Maybe 6 feet, maybe 200 pounds. Gray hair. Not thin, not thick, not short, not long. He was about 50. He was wearing a gray suit made out of expensive cloth, cut without any attempt at style. His shirt was white, and his tie was no color at all, like gasoline. His hands and face were pale, like his natural habitat was underground parking garages at night, hawking samples of something from his Cadillac's trunk.
"Sit down," he said.
His voice was quiet and strained, like it was all high up in his throat. I sat opposite him at the far end of the table.
"I'm Zachary Beck."
"Jack Reacher," I said. Duke closed the door gently and leaned his bulk against it from the inside. The room went quiet. I could hear the ocean. It wasn't a rhythmic wave sound like you hear at the beach. It was a continuous, random crashing and sucking of surf on the rocks. I could hear pools draining and gravel rattling and breakers coming in like explosions. I tried to count them. People say every seventh wave is a big one.
"So,"
Beck said. He had a drink on the table in front of him, some kind of amber liquid in a short, heavy glass, oily, like scotch or bourbon. He nodded to Duke. Duke picked up a second glass. It had been waiting there for me on a side table. It had the same oily amber liquid in it. He carried it awkwardly with his finger and thumb right down at the base. He walked across the room and bent a little to place it carefully in front of me. I smiled. I knew what it was for.
"So,"
Beck said again. I waited.
"My son explained your predicament," he said.
It was the same phrase his wife had used. "The law of unintended consequences," I said.
"It presents me with difficulties. I'm just an ordinary businessman trying to work out where my responsibilities lie."
I waited.
"We're grateful, naturally. Please, don't misunderstand that."
"But?"
"There are legal issues, aren't there?"
He said it with a little annoyance in his voice, like he was being victimized by complexities beyond his control. "It's not rocket science. I need you to turn a blind eye, at least temporarily, like one good turn deserves another, if your conscience can accommodate that kind of a thing." The room went quiet again. I listened to the ocean. I could hear a full spectrum of sounds out there. I could hear brittle seaweed dragging on granite, and a drawn-out undertow sucking backward toward the east. Zachary Beck's gaze was moving all over the place. He was looking at the table, then at the floor, then into space. His face was narrow, not much of a jaw. His eyes were set fairly close together. His brow was lined with concentration. His lips were thin, and his mouth was pursed. His head was moving a little. The whole thing was a reasonable facsimile of an ordinary businessman struggling with weighty issues.
"Was it a mistake?"
"The cop? In retrospect, obviously. At the time, I was just trying to get the job done." He spent a little more time thinking, and then he nodded.
"Okay. In the circumstances, we might be willing to help you out, if we can. You did a great service for the family."
"I need money."
"Why?"
"I'm going to need to travel."
"When?"
"Right now."
"Oh, is that wise?"
"Not really. I prefer to wait here a couple of days until the initial panic is over.
but I don't want to push my luck with you.
How much money?
$5,000 might do it. He said nothing to that, just started up with the gazing thing again. This time there was a little more focus in his eyes.
I've got some questions for you before you leave us. If you leave us. Two issues are paramount. First, who were they?
Don't you know?
I have many rivals and enemies.
That would go this far?
I'm a rug importer. I didn't intend to be, but that's the way things worked out. Possibly you think I just deal with department stores and interior decorators, but the reality is I deal with all kinds of unsavory characters in various foreign hellholes where enslaved children are forced to work 18-hour days until their fingers bleed. Their owners are all convinced I'm ripping them off and raping their cultures. The truth is, I probably am, although no more than they are. They aren't fun companions. I need a certain toughness to prosper. And the point is, so do my competitors. This is a tough business all around. So between my suppliers and my competitors, I can think of half a dozen separate people who would kidnap my son to get at me. After all, one of them did 5 years ago, as I'm sure my son told you.
I said nothing.
I need to know who they were, he said, like he really meant it.
So I paused a beat and recounted the whole event for him, second by second, yard by yard, mile by mile. I described the two tall, fair-haired DEA guys in the Toyota accurately and in great detail.
They mean nothing to me, he said.
I didn't answer.
Did you get the Toyota's license plate?
I fought back and told him the truth. I only saw the front. There was no plate.
Okay. So they were from a state that doesn't require a front license plate. That narrows it down a little, I guess.
I said nothing. A long moment later, he shook his head.
Information is in very short supply. An associate of mine contacted the police department down there, in a roundabout way. One town cop is dead, one college cop is dead, two unexplained strangers in a Lincoln town car are dead, and two unexplained strangers in a Toyota pickup truck are dead. The only surviving eyewitness is a second college cop, and he's still unconscious after a car wreck nearly 5 miles away. So right now, nobody knows what's happened. Nobody knows why it happened. Nobody has made a connection to an attempted kidnap. All anybody knows is there was a bloodbath down there for no apparent reason. They're speculating about gang warfare.
What happens when they run the Lincoln's plate? He hesitated.
It's a corporate registration. It doesn't lead directly here. I nodded.
Okay. But I want to be on the West Coast before that other college cop wakes up. He got a good look at me.
And I want to know who stepped out of line here.
I glanced at the anacondas on the table. They had been cleaned and lightly oiled. I was suddenly very glad I had ditched the spent shells. I picked up my glass, wrapped my thumb and all four fingers around it, and sniffed the contents. I had no idea what they were. I would have preferred a cup of coffee. I put the glass back on the table. Is Richard okay?
He'll live. I'd like to know who exactly is attacking me.
I told you what I saw. They didn't show me ID. They weren't known to me personally. I just happened to be there. What's your second paramount issue? There was another pause. The surf crashed and boomed outside the windows.
I'm a cautious man, Beck said, and I don't want to offend you.
But?
But I'm wondering who you are, exactly.
I'm the guy who saved your boy's other ear. Beck glanced at Duke, who stepped forward smartly and took my glass away. He used the same awkward pincer movement with his thumb and his index finger right down at the base. And now you've got my fingerprints, nice and clear. Beck nodded again, like a guy making a judicious decision. He pointed at the guns where they lay on the table.
Nice weapons.
I said nothing back. He moved his hand and nudged one of them with his knuckles. Then he sent it sliding across the wood toward me. The heavy steel made a hollow, reverberant sound.